What is up with taxes? I remember growing up, people joked about how much they hated taxes, but they paid them. And we had a solid middle class society. Real wages rose from World War II through 1973. Today, one of our two major political parties, nationally and in state capitals, is unwilling to even consider raising taxes, no matter the circumstances. And though most of Washington's officials and media are hysterical about the deficit and willing to hurt anyone in an effort to reduce it, both parties voted in December to extend tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans for 2 more years. Friday's New York Times, that's Friday the 25th, featured this headline: GE Strategies let it avoid taxes altogether. Despite profits of $14.2 billion, $5.1 billion from its operations in the U.S., General Electric did not have to pay any U.S. taxes last year. David Kochanowski reported, "Its extraordinary success is based on aggressive strategy that mixes fierce lobbying for tax breaks and innovative accounting that enables it to concentrate its profits offshore. GE is our nation's largest corporation, and its CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, recently replaced Paul Volcker as leader of President Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, as its name was changed to the Council for Jobs and Competitiveness." I last interviewed today's guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning tax writer David K. Johnston, in January 2009, on the day of Barack Obama's inauguration. And we talked then about how we might make the most of the opportunity that was presented by the financial catastrophe. Did the bailout make sense? And what could we do that might be smarter, more efficient, more effective, that might work? And in that month, January 2009's Mother Jones, Johnston had written, "We are at last at a turning point. We have a chance to end the socialism for the rich that put us into this hole. How? By, in effect, reverse engineering the debacle. Rewriting tax laws and financial regulations has been the principal vehicle for turning government into a subsidy system for the deep-pocketed and the well-motivated. It can work in reverse as well. We can start by eliminating some of the most spectacular tax giveaways and move on to a doable, efficient steps towards shoring up our biggest asset, not stocks, bonds, or houses, but people. Best of all, much of this won't cost a penny. In fact, it will raise billions for the big tasks ahead." David K. Johnston worked as an investigative reporter for several newspapers. He was with the Los Angeles Times here in L.A. from 1976 to 1988, and at the New York Times from 1995 to 2008, where he won a Pulitzer for his innovative coverage of our tax system. He now teaches the tax, property, and regulatory law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law and Whitman School of Management, and writes a column at tax.com. He's the author of two bestsellers, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. His next book, The Fine Print, will be published in 2011. Welcome again, David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you for having me, Terrence.
So I'm sure you didn't recall that, the auspicious or inauspicious moment of our last interview, but as I was doing research for this show, I noticed it. And if you'll allow me, before we focus on taxes, I'm going to set it up by actually some things that we said that day. So the first thing I want you to do is get ready for a broad reflection on these first 2 years of Obama.
Okay.
So that day I said, "Now it is up to us to demand the best of our president, our representatives, and ourselves. Due to the scale of our multiple calamities, we may finally be ready to make meaningful changes to the business as usual that has sapped us of our capacity to make the most of our collective moment on this earth. Let us pledge our commitment to participate in the difficult and demanding healing of our communities, our workplaces, our schools, our culture, our government, our environment, and our global society. We must be awake. We must be vigilant. We must be tireless. We must not settle." And I also read a quote from Rebecca Solnit. "The coming era doesn't mean that anyone can quit being political. After all, Obama, who is merely impressive as an individual, is unstoppable as a phenomenon created out of the collected hopes and desires of the public, which must continue dreaming and prodding him forward to make the world we want to see." David K. Johnston, your response.
Well, I think that the last 2 years have demonstrated quite clearly to us that President Obama, like everybody else who gets a serious shot at being president, has to be someone acceptable to the establishment in this country, and in particular acceptable to Wall Street. And you'll notice in the last couple of years that while we continue to suffer from the serious, serious problems left by the previous administration's policies, the solutions and the actions of Mr. Obama have all been very focused on what Wall Street thinks are the solutions to these problems, not the economic problems, not what you and I or any of the audience might think are the real problems.
Exactly. It's, I mean, it, if you, I mean, it, it was sad to read that stuff and just go, oh, you know, because to me, Obama's first 2 years have made it, as you pointed out, all the clearer that in the current system, it doesn't seem to matter because they all actually represent their funders and, given Citizens United, that will, I'm afraid, become even more the case.
Yes, and you know, Citizens United, if we can digress to that for just a second, is
sure.
an unbelievably important decision. I had my research assistants go back, and they're still working on this. They've been on it for weeks now. Gather everything they can find about the nature of corporations at the time of the founders. Because, you know, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas in particular argue that they are originalists and that their view of the Constitution is based on what the framers intended and the original intent, not some amorphous modern idea, right?
Exactly.
Well, so under Citizens United, we have granted essentially political rights to corporations, which are not natural entities. Justice Rehnquist, not exactly a raging liberal, in 1977, in a case called Bilotti, warned that it was one thing to grant property rights to corporations to protect their property, which is what the Supreme Court did without hearing in the Santa Clara case in 1886 that created personhood for corporations. But he warned you don't want to do this to political rights because those belong exclusively to natural persons, i.e. human beings. So it turns out back at the beginning of the Republic, corporations were incredibly tightly controlled. They could exist for a very limited period of time. For a specific purpose, they operated often only in a single state and were tightly regulated and controlled in every way you can imagine, as opposed to today where they do anything that they want to do and they do it all over the world. So if anything should make people cynical and disbelieving of Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas when they tell you that they follow the original intent of the Constitution, it is Citizens United. And Citizens United is to the expansion of corporate power what the Big Bang was to the creation of the universe. It is the whole universe.
Absolutely. I recall the corporation was at the, I think, was granted at the pleasure of the sovereign and in England. And, of course, in the United States, the sovereign is we the people.
Right. And over the years, we've extended this and extended this. At one time, New Jersey was the state of choice for corporations. It's now mostly Delaware. And corporations have figured out how to use the various state laws so that they earn all of their profits in states that don't tax them, notably Delaware, for a few of them, Texas or Florida. And then they take all their expenses in the states where they make their profits. So what effectively happens to state-level government, and after all, state-level government, remember, is what educates people.
That's right.
It's what operates, actually operates the healthcare system, doesn't so much finance it. That's done more in Washington, but there's a lot of it done at the state and local level. It runs the criminal justice system and provides most of the things that we need in our daily lives, you know, everything from the regulation of lawyers, inadequate as that may be, and I'm not a lawyer, and doctors, to running state parks and roads. And what the large corporations in America figured out how to do is to get all the benefits of this system and bear very little of the cost by exploiting differences among the states.
Yeah, and let me just point out, though, as David was saying those benefits, it sounded like those are the benefits to us, the individual citizens who live in these houses with our wives and children and so on. But those benefits, infrastructure, health care, a legal system, are absolutely essential for a corporation to function as well.
Yes, and corporations, of course, in many ways are the beneficiaries of that system. We have a whole variety of laws that have been set up that essentially give corporations significant advantages over ordinary folks.
Yeah. And so now, one thing I do sometimes, and I thought this might be a show where it works, David, although I have many specifics that I will want to get to, I want to frame it in three big questions. One is, how is the tax system broken? What's the evidence? You know, how can we look and say, clearly, that's broken? Second, how did it get broken? What's the history? What are the causes? And then finally, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? So the first big question, what's the evidence that the tax system in the U.S. is broken?
Well, tax revenues have been falling even as the population and the economy expands. At tax.com, I have a new column that went up March 28th in response to a criticism of an earlier column. And even if you pick the year 2001 as the year you're going to start comparing, that was, after all, the first year of the Bush tax cuts and a recession year, per capita income taxes in this country have fallen 32% to 2010. 32%. The total amount of money collected in the individual income tax has fallen 27% when the population grew by 8%.
Oh, my God.
Now, on the corporate side, the corporate income tax is almost flat. It went from $187 billion in 2001 to $191 in 2010. This is all adjusted for inflation to $2010 dollars. So it grew a little bit, 3%. But corporate profits had grown in real terms about 25% during that time. And per capita, that is, let's look at how much the corporate income tax is per American, it fell 5%. So without question, we live in a world that is becoming much more complicated and in which knowledge is the most important driver of economic growth. And yet, what are we doing? The state of New York just announced they're going to cut $800 million from spending on schools, on educating young people, which is really a choice to say, I want to save a few tax dollars today and not collect huge amounts of tax dollars in the future because the population will not be as well educated and won't make as much money.
And as you say, that is following the election of a Cuomo from one of America's progressive families and so on. And the New York Times, in its editorial on March 20th, said, Governor Cuomo has vowed to make the tough decisions and not be swayed by special interest pleadings, but he's refusing to impose any new taxes or even continue a current surcharge on New York's wealthiest and least vulnerable citizens.
Right. And by the way, in New York, you know, where we have these enormous fortunes that are made in Manhattan, has a state tax rate now at the top, which is half what it was a generation ago, half. Been cut from 15% to about 7%, and the highest rate cuts in at $500,000. So that means that people who make $500,000 a year pay the same tax rate as people who make $500,000 a day, and there are lots of them in New York.
Oh, my God. And so that's what he's unwilling to touch while he's making all these cuts.
Because apparently he's afraid they'll all move to New Jersey, and we all know what New Yorkers think of New Jersey. If you don't, there's the famous Steinberg.
Oh, right, right.
Cover
of New Yorker magazine.
In the New Yorker magazine, you know, there's once you cross the Hudson River, it's all just nothingness.
Until you get to California.
Yes.
That's right.
Although I have in my house from my L.A. days the opposite one drawn from Hollywood Boulevard.
But it's still the same. There's nothing in between.
Right.
Right. So the evidence that it's broken is that we now take in less taxes and grumble about it more and face deficits for which it seems across the board most people's solution is only to make cuts. And if you'll allow me, just for the sake of information and again to sort of set this up, independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont has introduced legislation which would impose a 5% surtax on households earning $1 million or more. And in his announcement, he lays out some of the cuts in the Republican House Budget Bill H.R. 1, because his guess, and mine as well, is that people don't know what it actually looks like. Jerry Brown, as you know, in California, is trying to do the same sort of thing, sort of laying out this is how bad it would be if you don't allow us to raise some taxes, and we'll see how that goes. The Republicans at this point aren't even allowing aren't even willing to allow it to go on the ballot. But these are just some of the cuts in the Republican House passed budget bill. This has already been passed, H.R. 1.
So, you know, let me go back to you.
Yeah.
This is the big question. What
yeah.
is the evidence that the system is broken?
Right.
Now, one of the things you will hear that spread all over the place is the top 1% pay half the taxes or 40% of the taxes. That's not true. There is something that's true, but it's very important to understand why this is not true. The federal individual income tax is about one of every $5 of all taxes raised in America. Remember, we have federal taxes, state taxes, local taxes.
And payroll taxes.
That's right. And I am ignoring now in this all the things that used to be covered by taxes that are now paid by fees. You don't have to be very old to know that we didn't used to have all these taxes imposed on every time. If you take a trip with a plane, you go three different planes, you have to pay three different fees for using the airport. And you pay a surcharge if you rent a car that's a tax. And all of these other things that are fees that are loaded onto you. College, when I was a young man and poor in California, college was free. Now, going to college is signing up for 20 years of debt for most people.
Right, which I mean, if people aren't thinking about that, just think, if you're of my generation or your generation, David, we came out maybe with some debt. I came out with a little bit of debt. But nowadays, people, by the time they graduate from college, rather than being able to take chances, be creative, and this goes exactly to what you were saying before about where is the future based in knowledge and based in people, not only are we making it harder for them to get that education, but we're making it harder for them to be creative once they get out because they come out loaded with debt.
Correct. So here's what's happened. It's very important to understand this. It is true the top 1% are paying around 40% of the total income tax.
Yes.
They also have earned as much as 23% of the income in recent years. They earned 21% of the income in 2008, the last year we have full data.
And what percent is that? Is that the top 1?
Top
1%.
21% of the income and paid about 40% of the income tax. But remember, you know, no one pays income tax, including the very rich, on your first about $9,300 if you're single, $17,000 if you're a married couple, a heterosexual married couple. So, because we exempt incomes at the bottom. If you tax those, you're just raising the price of everything, a point Adam Smith taught 230 years ago. So, while the income tax burden has gone to the top, you also need to recognize what's happened to incomes in America. The bottom 90% of Americans in 2008 earned a dollar and a penny on average for every dollar they earned in 1980. 28 years later, average income was up 1%, $300 and change for the year, dollar a day more per year. But at the top tenth of 1%, and by the way, that's where most of the income in the top 1% is, more than half of it goes to the top tenth of 1%, one in 1,000 families in America, that group saw their income for each dollar in 1980 grow by 2028 to more than $4.
Per dollar of taxes?
Per dollar of income. So
per dollar,
dollar they made on average in 1980, adjusted for inflation in the year 2008.
Oh, I see, right.
$4, but for the vast majority, the bottom 90%, for every dollar they made in 1980, they were only making a dollar and a penny.
Got it.
And so, yes, of course, the share of income taxes paid by people at the top has gone up because their income has gone up vastly faster.
That's right.
And their rates have been cut. I did an analysis of 1961 incomes because there's certain statistical reason we were able to do an analysis that otherwise you couldn't do, comparing 1961 to 2007. The bottom 90% after all taxes, higher income taxes, higher Social Security taxes, was making just a little bit more than they made back in 1961. They made 20 cents more. For each dollar they made $1.20 after almost a half a century. The group at the top got $36.50 after tax for
Whoa.
Every dollar made in 1961. That's 180 times as much growth.
Wow.
Now, that top group is the top 400 taxpayers, by the way. It's a smaller
oh,
group.
Okay.
But these are people who make about $1 million a day in the last few years. And so, you know, what we've done under Reaganism is we have redistributed income through a whole variety of means, suppressed unions, reduced taxes at the top, provided tax deferrals to people at the top, encouraged owners of businesses to withdraw capital, which means destroying jobs, from their businesses for their pleasure, so they can own, you know, expensive paintings and, what was it, John McCain couldn't remember if he and his wife had 7 homes or 9 of them.
Right.
Recall. And the result has been this explosion of incomes at the top and an absolutely flattening of incomes for the bottom 90%. And by the way, if you get into the bottom half, incomes are falling. People are making less now than they did 30 and 50 years ago when you adjust for inflation. So the tax system has broken down because of the changes that we've made, and the Republican answer to this is the same answer that George Washington's doctors applied to him when he got sick. You know, they bled him.
Exactly.
He didn't get better, they bled him more, and they ultimately bled him to death. Well, that's what the Republican policy is. The governments are, for a reason we're not growing, is taxes are too low. Let's cut them for the rich and cut them for the rich and cut them for the rich. And as this is happening, the economy keeps getting worse off because it is not true that high taxes destroy jobs. Low taxes destroy jobs by encouraging owners of businesses to withdraw money from the business.
I hadn't even thought about that. Okay. In other words, that's that whole small business owner kind of thing that is the
right.
Sort of the hallowed group that they claim they represent.
And remember that most small businesses, and I'm chairman of the board of a very small business, a couple $1 million of revenue, don't pay taxes. They don't make a profit. They are designed not to earn a profit. They are intended to draw down to zero so they pay no tax or maybe even have negative income and have losses. And if the owners want to take money, they take the money out of it as their personal income. Or they put it in their retirement plan, or they take it out by leasing cars and things. We don't do that. We're not big enough.
But the goal of your accountants is to zero you out at the end of the year.
That's right. Unlike a publicly traded company where the goal is to report the biggest profits you can to pump up the stock price. And at the same time, pay no taxes, like GE has not done. There are many companies that have year after year after year actually made money off the tax system because of the rules.
Right. Now, by the way, I want to tell people that's the voice of David K. Johnston. To me, the reigning expert on taxes in this country, author of Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and you can read his work. You're putting something new up there every few days?
No, I write a column at tax.com about every 2 weeks.
About every 2 weeks. And that's
and,
at tax.com.
I don't put all of them up there because this isn't a different journalism model. It is non-advertising. It's paid. It's non-profit. It's financed entirely with subscriptions. And it is very unusual in that there's no ideology of any kind.
Right.
The editor who runs one of the publications that I write for at tax.com regularly in his weekly, you know, here's what's in our 250 pages of journalism this week, you know, expresses his deep skepticism about what I have to say, but he never disputes that they're going to publish what I have to say.
Very good. And so you just, because most of what you said there in why the tax system is broken dealt with individuals, and we just got into corporations, and I am going to indulge myself here 1 second and read a little bit from the this is actually on rich taxpayers. Let me just do this. The Wall Street Journal on the 22nd, I'm sure you saw this. IRS targets rich taxpayers, audit rates up 80%. The rich not only face calls for higher taxes, this is the Wall Street Journal, they also face more audits to make sure they pay. And it turns out that the IRS in the last year increased its audits. What I love is the end of this brief article, which I'll allow you to comment on in a second, but it says it is unclear how much revenue the new effort has managed to snag, but at a time when government is increasing need of funds, the audits of the 10 million plus crowd are likely to continue rising as if the spending on the audits is going to break the government. And then the question at the end of this article is, do you think the new task force is welcome tax justice or capricious wealth redistribution?
Right. Well, first of all, the IRS's capacity to audit is wholly inadequate. In the late 1980s, if you were a high-income taxpayer, your odds of being audited were about 1 in 11. They've been as low in recent years as 1 in 400. They're currently a little under 1 in 100, probably about 1 in 75 If you're in the 10 million up crowd, your odds are much higher. They're more like 1 in 6. But the audit rates are still very low, and many of these audits are, and I say this having interviewed dozens and dozens of IRS agents who aren't supposed to talk to me, all over the country, spent a lot of the New York Times' money and my own money to go, you know, meet people. They're superficial, and they're told not to pursue things. And, you know, when I broke the story, boy, this was in 2004, of the backdated stock option scandal. I didn't pursue it, unfortunately. The Wall Street Journal did and won a Pulitzer Prize for it, but I broke that story. The IRS agent who stumbled across this, they were going to prosecute her. You know, in my book, Free Lunch, I say, no, we should erect the investors of America should erect a statue in honor of this woman, Remy Welling, up in Cupertino, for what she did. And the whole system came down in her head simply because she said, I'm not going to do something improper. I'm not going to stand by and look the other way and let you let this company get away now and forever with a crime. And the whole government came down on her head against you as an investor and you as an honest taxpayer.
Because she was actually putting some muscle and enforcement behind the word audit.
That's right.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we had the guy in San Francisco was the guy with a stellar, like, 30-year career at the IRS who was put in charge of collection. And he announced as soon as he was put in charge that they were going to go after the elite and the politically connected with the same fervor they were going after Joe Sixpack. And I tell about cases he went after, and he was gone after. He was literally put in a room with no windows and no computer and told to sit there for day after day after day. And they mucked up a charge to go after him because there was some pornography in his computer. Well, if anybody remembers back 10 years ago, you could just open an email and suddenly have all sorts of pornography exploding on your computer.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and they went after him over this. Plus, he had to... He'd used his computer to help one of his subordinates find an inexpensive airfare. For this, we should undo a 30-year career and discharge you in disgrace because it's such a serious misuse of the government's equipment.
Well, it's interesting. There's some muscle in that audit.
Right.
In their audit of him.
Right. And the people that he went after, I was able to show, he didn't tell me this, I was able to dig out the public record, were the family of former Mayor Alioto of San Francisco and Al Davis, the owner of the Raiders, and then a case involving Russian diamond smugglers that apparently the CIA and other national security apparatus had a deep interest in making sure no one from the tax department mucked around in what they were doing for reasons that have never been clear.
Let's talk a little bit more about corporations. This previous Sunday on 60 Minutes, they did a report on corporations fleeing the United States to avoid taxes. And one of the things they showed was how a number of companies have located in Zug, Switzerland. One of them was Transocean, the company that owned the oil rig in the Gulf oil spill, claimed that they were located in there. And the point that they're doing is, and this is one of the strategies that GE has used to pay no taxes, is that they push their profits wherever they may. For instance, a patent, they'll put the patent in Zug, Switzerland, or they'll put the software that brings them much of their income in Ireland. That's 12.5%. Talk a little bit about corporate maneuvers.
Well, first, it's important to know the 60 Minutes piece actually sort of defended this and treated corporations as sort of victims who had no choice but to do this, which I was somewhat troubled by.
Yeah, let me just tell people, if you haven't seen it, it's available. You can see it on the website over at CBS. But yeah, the guy who seems to get the most empathetic treatment is a fellow from Cisco who says, you know, we have to do it. We owe it to our shareholders, and the tax rate in the corporate tax rate in the U.S. is too high.
Yes, and none of this is new. I mean, in fact, my Pulitzer was for exposing this kind of stuff more than 10 years ago. What's changed, if anything, is the skill at marketing the idea that corporations are being abused. Now, we have made a decision to have this global multinational corporate environment. And having made that decision, certain things are going to flow from it. One of them we're seeing is falling wages. As I sometimes tell audiences, the most generous people in the history of the world are American blue-collar factory workers who have given up their opportunity to get into the solidly into the middle class so that the rural poor of China can have a better life. And these companies have all figured out the same thing on the international scale that the multinational, the nationwide companies have figured out on the U.S. scale. You take your profits in Delaware if you're a national company, and even though you earn them in New York and California and other places, and you don't pay taxes to those states. Well, multinational companies, even if they're based here, you take your profits in Zug, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein, and the Cayman Islands, and Bermuda, and you get all the benefits of being in the United States and also other countries. I mean, this is going on in Western Europe. It's a big problem there. It is less of a problem in Japan, but it is growing as a problem there. There was an effort more than 10 years ago by all the big industrial countries to do something called harmonizing their tax systems so that they could, would all agree to ignore transactions that were just designed to escape taxes. The Bush administration, one of its very first acts was to kill this. And
what did they kill? They killed the
effort of the big industrial countries to say we're all going to get the
Oh, I see.
We will not pay attention to tax dodges that are run through these parasitic countries like the Cayman Islands. You know, one out of every five banking deposits in the world is in the Cayman Islands, except there's nothing there.
Right.
It's just on paper. They're all in London and New York and Paris and Los Angeles. There's nothing in the Cayman Islands. That was the part of the thing that was shown on the 60 Minutes piece that one of the big companies, Weatherford, which is a $10 billion a year company, all it does is occasionally pay rent for a room they don't even go to.
So that's right.
They have an address in Zug, Switzerland.
I mean, it's like the folks here who have a mailbox as their corporate address because they don't really have a company.
Exactly the same thing. And so what's happened is that we have allowed corporations to set the agenda. Instead of corporations being the servant of everyone, they are an effective, efficient means to run companies and build wealth. We have instead made the entity our ruler. And there's a whole variety of things we're doing, aren't just taxes. I mean, you know that much of the ownership of corporations is very fleeting, right? People own hedge funds will own a stock sometimes for seconds.
Right.
And trade in and out of it. So that the employees who expect to work there for years and the customers who rely on the company for years are given no voice or authority, but people whose ownership lasts for, and sometimes literally seconds, have a greater voice. And by treating these entities as being special and as if we're dependent on these entities, we now allow them to do things pretty much as they want. So they say, you know, I don't like the tax system in the U.S. We're going to create all our jobs offshore. We're going to sell our products and our services in the U.S. We're going to take our products, our profits offshore, and we're going to get all the benefits of the American market, but we're not going to share in the burdens. And the inevitable result of that is what we are seeing. We are pushing the burden of taxes down the income ladder to the point where, for example, today in every one of the states, the poorest fifth of families bears a heavier tax burden at the state and local level than the top 1% of families. And at the federal level, a worker who makes the median wage, $26,000, half of all workers make more than that, half make less, pays a heavier burden than the top 400 taxpayers who make almost $1 million a day. And then on top of that, we have all these people who operate through another kind of entity who live tax-free. There are literally people who have made billion-dollar incomes year after year in America and pay no taxes legally. They're called hedge fund managers.
They pay no taxes on that?
That's right. You keep reading the newspapers that they pay
capital gains, or
that they pay a 15% capital gains rate, but they only pay that when they cash out.
Oh, and if so, that's how you make your living, you don't cash out. By the way, it's the same thing with
borrow. And if you need money, if you've got $9 billion in your account, and we know John Paulson made $9 billion in just the last 2 years alone, just go to your banker and say, hey, I need to borrow $300 million. And he loans it to you at a super cheap interest rate, currently less than 2%.
Right. And the corporations, there's also a rule similar to that, right, that they all have money that they are, profits that they haven't even taken out, that are sitting overseas, that they say, we would bring them back and help the American economy if we didn't have to pay any taxes on them. Talk about that one.
Well, yes. The assertion that if they didn't pay any taxes, they'd be better off is a driving force of this. And I can't tell you how many blue-collar workers and office workers who have told me that their boss has said to them that if he or she does not get a tax cut or their company doesn't get a tax cut, they're going to cut their wages. And this is a false set of false economics that we need to address. There are a lot of ways to solve this. So let me go to this, his solutions part of this. I was at a conference sponsored by the people who own tax.com, this nonprofit tax analyst that for 40 years has been fighting to make the tax system transparent and fair.
And as you said, with no ideology, but just transparent and fair.
That's our whole mission, and we publish people with a complete wide range of views every week and run one of the biggest newsrooms in Washington also. The discussion was about reforming corporate income taxes, and all the talk was about, well, let's lower the rate from 35 to 25 or 20. And I keep saying, well, listen, if you think this is complex and it's difficult, it's unfair, and I said this to the senior vice president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce who was at the table, I said, why don't we get rid of the corporate income tax? We would have to have some rules so that executives and owners of businesses, as opposed to big publicly traded ones, you know, somebody who owns their own business, can't live off the company. We'll have to have some rules about expense accounts and, you know, travel and company cars and all that. But that's nothing compared to the complexity of what we have now. Let's just reduce it to zero. And then we'll raise the tax you pay on any money you take out of the business. And this guy neatly dodged the question, saying, well, I would have to see the exact details of what you're proposing before I could comment on it. But the fact is, that wouldn't be popular with business at all because they don't want to pay any taxes. There is a whole body of literature that says that the very wealthiest people should not pay any taxes because they create jobs. Now, many of them don't create any jobs at all, but that's the theory, that if you are somehow a job creator, you should get to live tax-free in the idea that you will create more jobs.
And this obviously was the argument behind renewing the Bush tax cuts that both parties went along with in December. I mean, if not zero, that we keep it low and it will create jobs. And it's pretty clear that that doesn't work because, as anyone can know, if you give money to poor people, they spend it. If you give money to state governments right now, they would spend it so fast, you know, but to give it to the very wealthy, they are choosy about when and where and how they spend it.
Yes, exactly. And also, you know, what kind of you're going to have a healthy society if incomes at the bottom aren't better. And let me take you to some really interesting data about that. I've been tracking how much American workers make. There is a database that I discovered by accident one day that the Bush administration had actually put those anti-robot things on it so you couldn't find it doing a Google search. And I just by accident stumbled across it, and it is a to-the-penny measure of every buddy in America who has a job and how much they were paid. And it's the Medicare tax, and it goes all the way up to $50 million. So I can tell you how many workers in America make $50 million a year or more. It was 72 last year, or in 2009, and 74 the year before, and they made over $80 million on average. But the two things that matter are the median wage and the average wage. The median is half make more, half make less. And from the year 2000 to the year 2009, it's been almost totally unchanged. It's been a little over $500 a week every single year. It has not grown. That's very troubling. It grew 0.6% from 2000 to 2009. Even the peak year of 2007, when the economy is doing well, it had only gone up 2%. The average wage, however, has been going up, but not a lot. It's gone up from 2000 to 2009, 2.2%. And that's after 10 years. But what that tells you, and the average wage, by the way, is right around $39,000, $750 a week. But it's all because of the growth at the top.
Right.
75% of workers make less than $50,000 a year. 80% make less than $80,000. 75% make less than $80,000 a year. 99% make less than $200,000 a year.
Wow. Okay.
But the growth is all in this group of $100,000 and up jobs. Now, on the one hand, that's a good thing. People who have educations, people who have developed skills are being paid well. But at the bottom, remember what Richard Nixon said? At least I'm old enough to remember this. He once said that cleaning bedpans has the same dignity as the presidency. Well, how come we don't pay people that way? In Europe, janitors and practical nurses make enough money that they can live a decent life. But in America, they can't do that.
And by the way, when you say that about workers in Europe, are you saying they make enough to have a decent life because they make enough, or because the safety net of necessities is taken care of, or is it both?
Well, it's both. They, first of all, have minimum incomes policies, and then many, many things that you and I pay for with our after-tax dollars are paid for with the tax system there. So while Europeans have lower incomes and higher taxes, they generally tend to live better lives, and they have more job security, and when things happen, you know, only in America, among modern countries, do people go bankrupt because of medical bills, or do they die for lack of medical care? And what we're doing is immoral.
Absolutely.
You know, I am shocked by all the people who spout their religious beliefs as politicians and then say universal health care is wrong. They are no different than the people who 100 years ago said that if you want a child labor law, you are an agent of the devil, for it is God's plan that these children should be working in the mills. And it's the exact same thing. They spout their religious views, and then they act in the exact opposite of those views. And my concern is the hypocrisy of that, but it's also the practicality of it. Why do we put health care on the backs of businesses, including small businesses, instead of having the government handle it? If we ran public schools the same way we run the health care system, every kindergarten teacher would have to fill out a daily report, a cost accounting report.
Right.
I issued so many green crayons today, so many red crayons, so many paste pots, so many safety scissors to my kindergartners. That's what we do to doctors.
Yeah.
And it is wasteful. It makes a few people very, very rich, and it kills at a minimum more than 1,000 people a day for lack of health care, including 3 people when I lived in L.A. who all died because they didn't have medical insurance. They had medical insurance, they'd probably be alive today.
These were friends of yours?
These are friends of mine
in
Los Angeles when I lived there from 79 to 88. And I've known many people since then, I mean, elsewhere.
Yeah.
You can go to the emergency room. Emergency rooms don't treat cancer and diabetes. They treat emergencies. Healthcare isn't going to an emergency room.
And also the fact that we have this antiquated association of employers and insurance, which goes back to World War II, and it was a way to get around price controls. It's an inducement to send jobs overseas.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, when you go overseas, the costs are still there. Society bears them, but it does it on society's books, not on the company's books. And many of the people in America who have health care, they have terrible, crummy health care. They don't. I mean, imagine the average worker in America had been shot the way that Representative Giffords was in
Arizona. Yeah.
You think they would have been put in a private jet and flown to rehab in Houston, at the top place in the country for that?
Well, let's figure. Where do people get shot in America? I would imagine that a good percentage of them get shot in exactly those neighborhoods and parts of cities where that treatment does not happen.
That's exactly right, and many of them are just, you know, perfectly innocent people. I mean, I remember writing a lot of stories about drive-by gang shootings when I was at the L.A. Times. And so, you know, fundamentally what we've done with our tax system is we have bought into this idea that we have to cut taxes on the rich or we will all be poor. Well, you know, we've been doing this now for 30 years. The evidence is overwhelming that it hasn't worked. How much evidence do we need? I mean, do we need to literally do what George Washington's doctors did, bleed him to death, before we recognize we've made a mistake? Do we have to kill the country? Or at some point, do we say, you know, nobody else in the world is doing it quite the way we're doing it, and they're not having the same results that we are. They're having better results. They have unions in most of Europe and Japan for all the workers, and in some cases, not just managers, but low-level executives. Why do we think the lone individual should have to negotiate their job with, A, a giant corporation, or B, a giant government, instead of doing it collectively as a group? That's not a market where you, the individual, know nothing and the big employer knows everything.
Yeah, it's interesting. In both those cases, you're pointing out that we keep putting the work of negotiating your contract or dealing with healthcare and so on the individual or the small company, which obviously is an inefficient, ineffective way to do it. So in terms of solutions, it seems to me there's two steps there. One, what would work? And two, in the face of this overwhelming evidence that what is currently working is not working, and yet we get more of the same, what's it going to take to move in that direction? In terms of the solutions in the face of Citizens United, in the face, as I say, you've been doing this for years, pouring out the evidence. It doesn't seem to make any difference. Things only get worse. What is it really going to take?
Well, you know, there's a theory about democracies that they don't self-correct until they've gotten to a really serious deep crisis. And I don't think we're nearly as bad off as we could be before we begin to correct. But the developments in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio suggest that there is an awakening going on among many workers that their interests are here. Governor Walker tried, you know, to separate the police and the fire.
From the teachers and others,
yeah. The teachers and the nurses. And I would suggest anybody who wants to understand the reason he did that might want to read Plato and Aristotle on how tyrants can be identified early on by how they surround themselves with bodyguards. The outcome of this will be very important. If, in fact, Governor Walker, Governor Kasich, and in Michigan, Governor Snyder succeed in their drive, then I think we're going to see a complete corporatization of the culture, worsening incomes for all but the top 10 or 15% of the population. And there's a large movement in this country to end public education and to end public parks. Milton Friedman, who's revered as a god by the Republican establishment, wanted to eliminate all public parks and all public municipal golf courses, for example, because these are the coercive misuse of the power of the state, and all parks should be private. And the amount of subsidies will go up. On the other hand, if there are recalls and this movement is stopped, I think then you will begin to see some swinging back away from these very extreme positions, which are not based, by the way, on market capitalism. They are based on something I call corporate socialism, in which the government sets the rules in such a way that profits are privatized and losses are socialized. And the massive hidden subsidies that I exposed in Free Lunch to corporations might be wheeled back some, and we'll begin to say, how do we create a stable society that rewards people who play by the rules, that reinforces virtuous behavior, that self-punishes vicious behavior? And my books talk about various techniques that we can do this with in my next book, which is about pricing and how companies artificially jack up prices to people and charge for things that don't even exist, like taxes that don't even exist, and force you to pay them through subtle means. We can begin to change that. But there's another element to this, and that is we have created a society where we worship people for being rich, or maybe in the case of people like Donald Trump, the appearance of being rich. And we do it, you know, what did Martin Luther King say? I want my four little children to grow up in a world where they'll be judged not by the color of their skin, but the content of their character. And we have instead created a society where you are judged by the presumed content of your wallet. That is no basis to sustain a society. None at all.
Yes, and certainly not a civilization, if you know what I mean. You can have a society like that for a while, but it's not a social system.
And none of that, Terrence, is to argue we don't want to have wealthy people. I mean, I'm somebody who started out, I had to go to work when I was 10 years old and full-time when I was 13, because my dad was 100% disabled veteran of World War II. And I'm a reasonably wealthy man today because I've been prudent and I've been very lucky, and a lot of people helped me along the way. So my objection here is not to money, but if you're going to make money, make it in the marketplace. Don't have the government pass a law that makes you pay a tax to give it to Warren Buffett so he can be richer, or that lets somebody else borrow money and not have to pay it back on the scale of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars, or give them huge interest-free loans from the government that last decades. Don't do that. Earn it in the marketplace. Earn it because you decided it was important to you to make money. But let's recognize you can't have a functioning society without police officers who are competent and educated and know what to do, without nurses, librarians, school teachers, all of these other functions that are necessary for a society to work. And the foundation of private wealth is commonwealth. We are destroying our commonwealth, eating it up, letting roads and bridges and dams fall apart so that the already rich can have more and more and more. And that's just not a smart strategy.
Now, it strikes me that you've also done some talking and writing over the last few years about the role that the media plays in this, because that this would be going on in to the extent it is seems only possible with a terribly failed media.
Well, now I think it'd go on even if the media were doing their job. But having said that, the media have done a crummy job, and they've done it for a couple of key reasons. First of all, most news is he said journalism. That is, when you read that the president or John Boehner or Mayor Villaraigosa said something yesterday, he said it, okay? But whether the journalist understood what it meant is a whole different question.
And whether he checked whether it were true or accurate is another.
That's correct. And the first rule of journalism is check it out. The second rule is cross-check and cross-check, not until you know all sides of the story, but you also know where that story belongs in the universe, what its importance and relative connection is to other things. And those two rules have been breaking down as we have had these huge cuts in the media. When you go back and look at the LA Times in the 60s and 70s and 80s, it had lots of flaws. You and I could sit here and spend hours picking lint off it. It's also an incredibly fine newspaper that did a lot of good things, including my coverage of the LAPD that changed everybody's understanding of how it operated.
That's right. There was a David K. Johnston before he became a tax wonk.
That's right. But increasingly, what we're seeing is coverage by talking point and unskeptical acceptance of points. And Dean Baker runs a website called Beat the Press. It's a blog. Every day he finds stories in the Washington Post, especially the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times, that have economic nonsense in them. And I've in a number of cases written to the ombudsman at the various papers saying, you know, you have a story today that is just absolute nonsense as a matter of textbook economics. I never see that anybody fixes anything. Occasionally I get a note saying, thank you, we talked about it. But what the far right, the Koch brother funded organizations and stuff have come to understand is that if you can polish an idea, you can sell it just the way 50 years ago young men put Brill Cream in their hair because grease was supposed to make you sexy. Or you smoke cigarettes and they ran ads saying, you know, 4 out of 5 doctors.
Exactly.
Lucky strike. They're just absolute lies that are ideological and economic marketing to help the already rich make themselves richer. And the news media, because so much of it is he said journalism, because most journalists are innumerate, they do not understand numbers, most people don't understand numbers, and because very few of them have ever taken even one course in public administration, for example, or public policy, or statistics, they get bamboozled every day of the week. And the odds here have been changed tremendously. You have these huge factories turning out information. And then to expect, you know, the relative handful of reporters, you know, that's just absurd. There are 14, the last time I checked, there were 35,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, and they changed the rules some, and a bunch of people aren't registered anymore. But there are literally several tens of thousands of people in D.C. whose job is to influence Congress and the regulatory agencies. there aren't that many reporters.
No, right, right,
there's
exactly.
There's a tiny number of them in comparison. And so they're totally outgunned. On the other hand, they're not, you know, they're also not skeptical enough. And that's a real problem, that journalists need to remember your job is to be skeptical of everybody. There's a phrase I every lecture I give on journalism all around the world, I'd say, first rule of journalism, check it out. Your mother says she loves you, check it out.
Okay, we got to close it there, David. The books are Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal, and the column is at tax. The columns are at tax.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly, either at my website or at iTunes. My website's terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, whichever one's easier for you to remember. You can also sign up at my website or by emailing me at TEMcNally@mac.com to have an announcement every week emailed to you that tells you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about in two or three articles about the issues. Finally, thank you to David K. Johnston, and keep up the good work.